This podcast is brought to you by the Village of Bedford Park, your home for business. Over 450 businesses strong and growing with a safe, reliable Lake Michigan water supply. Visit villageofbedfordpark.com and bring your business home to the Village of Bedford Park.
Now, the WBBM Noon Business Hour.
It's 12:03 on Thursday afternoon, August 13th. Good afternoon. Thanks for joining us. I'm Rob Hart. The Noon Business Hour is sponsored by finishingchicago.com. Don't wait for that next storm to teach you some lessons the hard way. Here's what you can do now to be ready. We'll talk about that in our next segment. But first, people have been saying for years that Social Security is going to run out of money. But it's not true. Even if Congress does nothing to shore up the system's finances. Beginning in 2032, it'll still be able to pay out 78% of the benefits to which recipients are entitled. We welcome in Mark Hulbert, investment columnist for the Wall Street Journal, Barron's, and MarketWatch.com, based in Washington. Mark, thank you for joining us today. And I remember being on the debate team in high school and talking about the issue of Social Security and that it was going to run out of money sometime in the early 21st century. Well, Mark, here we are in the early 21st century, and Social Security is still here, and we're talking about it.
That's right, and this isn't the first time that it's, quote-unquote, going to run out of money. The last time was 1983, and just like you pointed out in your debate years ago, the actuaries of Social Security had predicted for years in advance of that date in 1983 that the system was going to run out of money to pay 100% of entitled benefits. And as politicians are wont to do, they kick the can down the road almost to the very last minute. Then President Reagan didn't sign into law the amendments to the Social Security Act that allowed it to continue paying 100% of entitled benefits until something like 70 days prior to the drop dead date. And my hunch, just guessing how politicians act, we're going to wait until the very last minute to do the same thing here.
Now, from an actuarial standpoint, though, there could be some real pressure in the not-too-distant future coming from people who live a lot longer. Therefore, the payout will be a lot more extended, combined with what a lot of demographers say is new births dropping off a cliff sometime in the first decade of the 21st century.
Well, absolutely. And that is the reason why the actuaries are saying that that the system will not have 100% the money to pay out 100% of entitled benefits. They carefully take into account every year when they update their forecasts. It's a 75-year forecast. They look ahead 75 years and taking into account everything from the projected economic growth rate to inflation to fertility, as you mentioned, to how long we're going to live. They come up with estimates of when the money will run out, so to speak. And that's why they're currently projecting that in 2032, it will only be able to pay out 78% of the benefits. And I think it's very crucial, as you pointed out in the intro, 78% is not the same as zero. And I think there's a lot of fear-mongering out there that suggests that we're going to just not be able to pay any Social Security benefits. I don't want to sugarcoat a 22% drop. But it's not a complete drop. And even at 78% of full benefits, Social Security will still be the 800-pound gorilla in the retirement space.
What do they call it? The third rail of politics as well, which is why you believe politicians will eventually take action. What are some potential future fixes, though, for shoring up the Social Security fund so it can pay out 100% of benefits past 2032?
Well, I think if we boil it down to brass tacks, it means that we're going to have to reduce benefits that we pay out and or increase the amount of the Social Security tax. And the amounts that you have to increase the tax or reduce the benefits are not great in any absolute sense. In fact, one way of looking at it is in 1935, when the act was initially signed into law by Franklin Roosevelt, the average life expectancy of the typical American was a lot lower than it is today. So if we simply made the change to account for the fact that we're living longer than we did before, but still pay benefits at the point at which it would be corresponding to what it would have been in 35, then we would go a long way to bringing the Social Security system back into solvency.
Mark Hulbert, investment columnist for the Wall Street Journal, Barron's, and MarketWatch.com, based in Washington. Thank you for joining us today.
Cash, credit, debit, and totally free. The WBBM Noon Business Hour continues.
This week's storms are a reminder that a little pre-planning now, from generators to flashlights to first aid kits, can prepare you for the next emergency. Joining us on the Village of Bedford Park business line, reminding you to bring your business home, is Steve Spears, spokesman for Northern Tool and Equipment in Bolingbrook. Steve, thank you for joining us today on the Noon Business Hour. And we, as homeowners especially, might think of ourselves as prepared for any contingency. And then, as Mike Tyson likes to say, Steve, everyone has a plan until they're punched in the mouth. And you might think you're prepared until the lights go out, and then you realize you aren't.
That's right. That's right. Yeah, thanks for having me today. You need a plan, right? Just like you said, you got to have a plan specifically around safety. How do I make sure that the family has a place to go to get to somewhere safe in the home or even outside the home, just to make sure that we are going to kind of come out of the other side of this storm in a safe way? You'll also want to have some really important equipment on hand to handle anything that a storm can bring, which typically brings power outages, downed trees, lots of cleanup efforts after a storm. So having that equipment ready to go is critical.
And speaking of handling power outages, this is something that a lot of people have had to deal with in the last month or so. And when we had those very severe storms at the end of July, there were a number of people who were out for several days at a time and probably kicked the tires on a generator. Do you have to go that far, or are there other ways that you can cope with an extended power outage?
Yeah, there's many ways. The most ideal way is a portable generator that runs on multiple fuel sources, can run just on the fuel you put in your vehicle. But we also have, you know, generators that can run on propane or natural gas. There's a lot to consider when buying a generator because there's so many different types and sizes, and it really depends on what you want to power. You know, during this time of year, it's making sure that you can still stay cool. So running a fan, making sure that the refrigerator and freezer continues to run, as well as, of course, lights and some of the amenities that we get used to. But there's critical components in your home, like the fridge, freezer, the sump pump, the furnace, even the air conditioner can be really critical components that a generator can keep you running until that power is restored. So, you know, there's a lot to consider, everything from the sound. Some of these can be very loud. Some can be very quiet. There's also how long do you need it to run on a full tank of gas? Is this something that you want to run overnight and it continues to run all night long? Or do you want to be fueling it up every 3-4 hours? The other big consideration would be just how much power is really necessary. So there's a lot to consider. It could be overwhelming because of the number of options and brands that are out there. You know, our own Power Horse brand, North Star brands that we carry in-house, and our expertise in this particular field is a great way to find the right one for you. So I would encourage your listeners to either go to our website, northerntool.com, or stop into one of our local stores, talk to one of the folks to really understand this product line and get you into the right unit for you.
And then also when it comes to having a source of power, this is something we talked about before with EVs, is that essentially if you own an EV, you're driving around town in a rolling battery. Can you plug your EV into your house as a source of power? And if so, what type of equipment do you need?
Yeah, there's nothing that would allow you to plug your vehicle into your home without some modifications to your electrical box. I'm sure an electrician could come out to your home and convert the power from the DC power coming off the battery into the electrical panel, but it's not something that you just buy off the shelf.
And then lastly, and very quickly, and this seems like some basic stuff, have a flashlight around. But the reality is a lot of people don't know where the flashlight is until they really need one. So if they want to go buy some new flashlights that can work in an emergency, what are you looking for?
Yeah, you're looking for the kind that can be recharged pretty quickly, especially if you have that portable generator. Now you can charge the batteries without having to buy actual batteries. But there's all kinds of flood lamps, headlamps, flashlights that that have multiple capabilities to them with different sources. So I think There's a lot of options to choose from anymore as it relates to a flashlight. So definitely something for your listeners to check into and get the one that works best for them.
Steve Spears, spokesman, Northern Tool and Equipment in Bolingbrook. Thank you for joining us today on the Noon Business Hour. Some other things you should look into: extra batteries, walkie-talkies perhaps, a first aid kit, whistles and signaling equipment, reflective tape, and of course, put together a family emergency plan. Chances are your kids have had to work on a family emergency plan. Either they do it in school or maybe through scouting or some other extracurricular activity, but make sure you as the adult are putting together that family emergency plan. How do you get out of the house? Where do you meet? And these are all small expenses, but they could head off some major repair bills you could have to pay down the road.
The WBBM Noon Business Hour continues.
Ford is shifting production from China, and Chicago could benefit. Joining us to explain is John McElroy, automotive industry analyst and host of Autoline.tv in Detroit. John, thank you for joining us today on the Noon Business Hour. What models are being moved from, are being reshored, essentially?
Yeah, there's only one Lincoln model there, Rob, and that's the Nautilus. Ford is going to bring it back to the U.S. to be assembled here. They haven't officially announced exactly where it's going to go, but Chicago is probably a good bet.
Now, what is the body template for the Lincoln Nautilus?
It's an SUV. It's a luxury SUV. In fact, it happens to be Lincoln's best-selling SUV. It's a pretty cool vehicle. I mean, it's got A-pillar screens. It's got a lot of technology in it, and I think that's what's attracted so many people to buy it.
And we don't know yet, but potentially Torrance Avenue could potentially be the beneficiary of that. And also, what's Ford's output at Torrance Avenue these days? A plant that's just celebrated the century mark.
Yeah, they make the Explorer there, I believe, and the Lincoln version of that. So there's two models in that plant right now, as I recall. That's why it's probably a good bet that it could go to the Chicago assembly plant, as they call it. Look, they don't sell a whole lot of Nautiluses. I mean, it's under 30,000 a year in automotive volume. That's pretty small volume. But, you know, there's been 100% import tariffs on any Chinese vehicle coming in. That actually started under the Biden administration, and the Trump administration kept it going. And so I'm sure what Ford looked at is, man, we're paying a lot in tariffs here. Let's bring that vehicle back stateside. And, you know, there's a big move in the U.S. auto industry now to not depend on China for anything. I mean, it's almost impossible to do, and it's going to take them years to get off that. But this is a good example of that process.
And this is going to begin sometime around 2030. And you mentioned some of the macroeconomic factors that were at play, the tariffs on importing these vehicles from China. But it seems like everybody in manufacturing has learned a big lesson from the supply chain crunch that we experienced coming out of the COVID pandemic, when you had all of those cargo ships waiting for someone to unload them in Los Angeles. That just-in-time delivery model that worked so well for so long can cause real headaches if it starts to break down.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. You know, just-in-time is still the best way to go. It not only makes your operations a lot more efficient, it improves quality. Obviously, those two things end up lowering cost. But you're exactly right, Rob. If there's a supply chain disruption, I mean a major supply chain disruption, then, you know, all bets go out the window. Instead of just in time, you want just in case. You want a bunch of inventory just in case something goes wrong.
John McElroy, automotive industry analyst, host of Autoline.tv in Detroit. Thank you for joining us today, talking about the reshoring production of the Lincoln Nautilus SUV to the U.S. from China, potentially could be built in Chicago. Still ahead in Technology Thursday, from flip phones to mini discs, why Gen Z is partying like it's 1999.
The WBBM Noon Business Hour continues.
Good afternoon. I'm Rob Hart. The Noon Business Hour continues, sponsored by FinishingChicago.com. Markets are mixed. We welcome in Shah Galani, founder and chief investment strategist, Answer Market Analytics in Sarasota, Florida. Shah, thank you for joining us today on the Noon Business Hour. And some more encouraging news when it comes to inflation, Shah, this time on the wholesale side.
Well, I think the numbers that we're seeing in terms of the outlook for inflation and what we're experiencing right now points to the Fed likely staying put and not raising rates, because there was some thought there that there was some perhaps push to maybe raise 25 basis points. I don't think that's going to happen. Markets like the fact that the Fed is probably going to be on standby. And then we see some softening in the jobs market. And I think that also perhaps portends, if not, you know, remaining on the sidelines, possibly a cut later in the year. So markets certainly like that. And that's part of the reason for the bullishness.
And of course, with economic numbers that don't set off any alarm bells, investors can once again focus on earnings season.
And earnings have been absolutely stellar, Rob. I mean, besides some of the misses, the majority of companies that have reported, something like 73%, have beaten expectations on top line and the bottom line. So earnings growth is, once again, this quarter, double digits. We're about 13%. For some of the tech names, we're north of 26% earnings growth year over year, quarter versus quarter. These are outstanding numbers. And certainly, you know, we've seen some rotation, you know, out of software stocks into the AI narrative names, and all of a sudden out of the AI narrative names back into the software stocks. Now all boats seem to be rising. So it's generally a broad-based rally, and market's looking pretty strong here.
Now, at the same time, as earnings season continues to impress, the markets don't reward good reports equally. Sometimes you can have an earnings beat that does not impress investors, and at that point, your stock gets punished.
Well, some of the earnings beats are accompanied by, I would say, tepid forward guidance. And I think that's really what investors are focusing on. There's some companies that have had some pretty good numbers in terms of the quarter, but their forward guidance was tepid, if not somewhat negative. And those took a hit because everybody is looking at everything getting built into the price right now. Things do look frothy on some fronts, for sure. And so investors who look forward think that, well, a second, if the best has already happened, then maybe we need to sell positions. And that's why we're seeing some of those names that report well but guide poorly get hit hard.
And then once again, it seems like the U.S. and Iran are no closer to finding a resolution over the Strait of Hormuz. And yet, at the same time, the oil markets are pretty much tuning it out.
Yeah, they're sort of flatlining in here, but you bring up a great point. And something I want to add to that is the market's big moves this year have been on the prospect of some resolution to the Iran war and oil prices coming down. Those have been big days as far as market moves. And I think that's also in the offing. If investors are expecting at some point some resolution and oil prices to come down, we get another step higher in the market. So oil is still on the front line as far as investors thinking.
Shah Galani, founder and chief investment strategist, Answer Market Analytics in Sarasota, Florida. Thank you for joining us today. Coming up next in Technology Thursday, everything old is new again. Why Gen Z is falling in love with gadgets from the past.
Money conversation that pays a big dividend. The WBBM Noon Business Hour continues.
It's Technology Thursday. Gen Z is going retro, embracing dumb phones, old game consoles, and vintage gadgets as younger consumers seek simpler, less connected technology. Welcome in tech expert Paul Hochman, former tech editor of the Today Show, president of Humongous Media. Paul, thank you for joining us today. And Paul, I want you to make me feel really sad right now. What's the definition of retro as far as Gen Z is concerned?
Okay, I'm sorry. I'm not going to even go with that. I'm going to actually make you feel good because you used the word dumb, old, and vintage in your intro there. and that's exactly what I am. So the thing is—
You and me both, Paul.
Yeah, well, guess what? The trend is really exciting to me, and then we'll get into the numbers, which is big business, by the way. But But the trend is towards devices and technology that I can actually operate. and it's true. Gen Z is really flocking to what we older people consider to be retro or, you know, sort of backward looking. And, you know, an easy example, vinyl records, right? Now, this is a trend that's been going on for some time, but they just this year went past $1 billion in annual sales and annual revenue for vinyl records. Film photography. Global film sales grew 127% this last year. 40% roughly of new film photography customers are under the age of 25. Print books, 75% year-over-year surge. 80% of books bought by 13 to 24-year-olds are printed copies. Now, this is not a small issue. What it means, obviously, is big business. But what it also means is it's a bit of a kickback against what is an obvious surge in digital technology in everyday life, whether it's AI or other, a concern for things that are not seeming to be real, a concern about resources. Is that digital? Is that AI slop or is it real person? My almost 18-year-old son sort of, you know, said, oh, that's not a good idea, Dad, if you're going to use AI because you're going to use too much water. So my point is not to make fun of that. My point is to say that's a huge business trend and an observation anybody in this world should take note of.
Well, it's very interesting. This dovetails with some new numbers that we're seeing about usage of social media applications, Facebook and other text-based social media that millennials embraced because Facebook was available to them when they were in college, and then people my age and our parents embraced because Mark Zuckerberg opened that up for everybody. But the kids, their kids aren't really embracing social media to the degree that their older siblings and their parents did. And maybe it is that search for authenticity and also a desire to get away from algorithms governing your life.
That's exactly right. The only thing I'd amend about your statement is the maybe part. It's quite clear, at least from the data that I've seen, that people, especially young people, Gen Z in particular, are tired of disbelieving their environment, disbelieving their surroundings. And the disbelief comes from the junk, basically, that comes over the transom driven by an algorithm that Zuckerberg or Musk or somebody else has mastered. So in a nutshell, it's not so much about the medium it is about the content. Is it real or not? Authenticity really is the word of the day. You want to sell a product these days? Authenticity is the byword if you're going to be successful.
The physical media, I understand, because once again, it goes back to the algorithm discussion. Do you want to control the experience? And on top of that, I remember this from birthdays and holidays. It was a lot of fun to open up a present and there's a VHS or a CD or a record, something you can hold and really look forward to enjoying. And you don't have that experience when you purchase it friction-free in an online store.
First of all, that's absolutely right. And second of all, I think in addition to the frictionless sort of purchase, which has its own virtues and its drawbacks, in the end, in some ways, which we haven't talked about directly, but I think it's really important, it's about ownership. In the end, a product, a physical product, whether it's a vinyl record or, you know, God help us, a VHS tape or something of the like, a film camera where the film cartridge has been rolled up and gets sent to some, it's a thing you hold. It's a thing you own. And I think the undertone of all this, or a lot of it, is when people are awash in a digital sea, they don't feel like any of that sea is owned by them. They feel like they're almost the recipient of all that energy. Instead, if you own a record, if you own the film, if you own the camera, you feel like you're connected to the experience as well as to the device. So I think ownership is part of it, too.
And then lastly, on the film camera discussion, I mean, Kodachrome does give us those nice, bright colors and the greens of summers and all the world's a sunny day. But the reality is, the pictures that you take on your phone do seem like short moments in time. And if you take a picture on film, it just has this depth that in your mind's eye, it looks like it's going to last forever.
I think that's exactly right. I mean, if there's a real syndrome where people will take a picture of damn near anything, forgive me, and they will forget about it in about 8 seconds. In other words, they're glad they had the moment, you know, selfies included. The number of selfies taken by Gen Z, I think, exceeds the number of words spoken in human history, you know? So there's a whole ton of it, but to your point, it devalues it. And so, yes, something that actually is owned, sure, but then ends up as a physical thing you can look at, does suggest longevity, does suggest that it's going to be around for a while, and therefore adds to its value.
Paul Hochman, president of Humongous Media, thank you for joining us today on the Noon Business Hour.
An economy of words. The WBBM Noon Business Hour continues.
You spend hours polishing your resume, researching the company, preparing for the big interview. Then you log on. Then you discover the person asking the questions isn't a person at all. Joining us on the Village of Bedford Park business line, reminding you to bring your business home, is Chris Stegg, Chief Technology Officer at eGroup in Chicago. Chris, thank you for joining us today. Now, having an AI agent conduct the first round of screening interviews could be a very good productivity tool, because if you work at HR, you've got a million other things to do. But couldn't that eventually cost the organization in the long run?
We will see. Early results say no, that it's a benefit to both the employer and the employee, because sometimes the employee spends less time during an arduous human interview than they otherwise might have. It won't take long to know the trend, though, Rob, because already we have 1 in 5 U.S. employers using generative AI video interviewing, believe it or not.
So does this mean when you log in for the Zoom interview, you're just an avatar will be talking to you and asking questions?
Usually. And the avatars take different formats, you know, usually the brand of the organization, the voice of the organization, et cetera. Sometimes it's not, though. They don't want to fake it, because that's kind of gimmicky these days in a way. People have a good time interacting with these things by saying, stand up, turn around, what's the weather today? And they won't be as likely to do so if it's just a voice that's interviewing them with a, you know, a blank screen or the like.
Now, if you are the person making the hire, you really want to evaluate new employees on their soft skills. Do they fit in this organization? Do they fit our culture? Can I see myself working with this person for months or years on end? And can the AI do a very good job of winnowing down candidates who meet those criteria?
That's the soft skills assessment these things have at their fingertips, which after years of training and watching many videos that these systems are trained on, they can tell if a person is flinching, if they raise their eyebrows, if they make good eye contact. So yes, for a specific type of job, we're interacting with the public or public speaking or, you know, just being on Zoom calls all day long. Those tools are actually very highly trained and coveted for their ability to track and use that information to see if this person's a good fit for the job. So in that case, it's a benefit to the employer, which then can train the system to look for certain attributes as they interview these people remotely.
What kind of positions are these AI tools being used for?
It's a variety. There's a public case study of Unilever doing it for white, you know, collar work, where people are doing info work and the like. However, it's starting to maybe take a trend down towards more hourly work, too. McDonald's here locally uses a system which has started that path. Employees can text their friends in a opening, and then the friend interacts with a conversational AI to do some qualifying screening questions. So we're seeing it in the hourly wage work as well, which may be even more cost effective for the employer.
Chris Stegg, Chief Technology Officer, eGroup in Chicago. Thank you for joining us today.